Hello, welcome to Playback Daily. It's Wednesday, the 11th of June. I'm Louise Herity, and here's some of what's coming up.
I have a greater respect for my body than I ever had. Prior to that, I would have drank like a fish.
Yeah.
I would have occasionally smoked a cigarette on a night out. Wouldn't dream of it. I've run 3 marathons since. I'm in the shape of my life.
It means where I belong and kind of gives me an identity and a security. And you're treated equally in this country when you hold that, I think.
But Ireland has been seen as the most lonely country in Europe. That's the highest rate of loneliness in Europe. And I think that's a warning bell.
Today marks the launch of an exhibition by EPIC, the Irish Emigration Museum, entitled On the Move, A Century of the Irish Passport. It'll showcase the rich history associated with the passport, as well as the personal stories of millions who've used it to travel around the world. One of whose stories will feature is Zach Moradi, the former Leitrim hurler and author originally from Kurdistan. He told Sheila Nocton on Morning Ireland about his journey to Ireland and getting his passport.
Well, we're originally from Kurdistan. Kurdistan was divided between 4 different countries. So our people, close to 30 million Kurds, we were left stateless. Iraq-Iran war started in 1980. And then my family became a refugee and we ended up in a refugee camp in Iraq. And then we ended up in Ireland as a political program refugee.
So then talk me through the journey or the process you went through to get an Irish passport.
It was actually, mine was a lot more difficult to get because I didn't have a birth cert. The day I was born, the Americans were bombing Iraq that night, so I was actually born in a tent. I never held a birth cert, so it was actually a longer process for me trying to get my Irish passport. But eventually I got it. You know, I was delighted. Obviously, it's the only passport I hold. I don't hold any other passports or any other nationalities. It's not straightforward. You know, I think it's a lot more easier if you hold another nationality passport, because I don't really have a nationality. It was a lot harder, but eventually I got it. I got all my paperwork.
So now that you have the Irish passport, what does it mean to you to have that document?
It means where I belong and kind of gives me an identity and a security. And you're treated equally in this country when you hold that, I think.
The lengths that Zach Moradi went to there to hold an Irish passport. He was speaking to Sheila Nocton. And for more on the work that went into this exhibition, we're joined by Catherine Healy, historian in residence at EPIC, the Irish Emigration Museum. Catherine, this is a great idea. Tell us a little bit more about how you developed it.
Thanks, Mary. So this is an exhibition commissioned by the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade to mark a century since the introduction of the Irish passport. So we dug into archival records, into government records, and looked at how the passport came to be introduced in the first place shortly after the founding of the Irish Free State. The very first passports were issued to the Irish delegation that travelled to Geneva to seek admission to the League of Nations in 1923, and they were made available to the public then a year later. We look as well at some of the many ways a passport has changed. You know, if you look at the early passports, they're issued in the name of His Britannic Majesty. Ireland was still a British dominion at this time. That reference was eventually removed in 1939. And amazingly also, married couples often travelled on joint passports. That was a practice that continued right up until the early 1990s.
But of course, a woman wouldn't need her own passport.
Yeah. And of course, the main holder was typically the husband. Yeah. And only the main holder was allowed to travel on it. So there's a lot of interesting social history tied to the development of the passport, too, which we look at.
And you're talking about how it evolved over the years. Let's look at another evolution of the Irish passport, because your exhibition documents the changing look of the passport, which is, I suppose, one of the most significant would have been one many people will remember, the switch from the green cover to the burgundy, which was in line with other EU member states. And that happened back in the 1980s. Here's an RTÉ report by Mary Fanning. It was broadcast in November 1984 on people's thoughts on the change.
I preferred the old one. I think they should have that green as well.
But it's a common colour for the member states. Do you not think that's right?
In a way, but again, I think it should be sort of green, because I think of Ireland when I look at the old ones.
I think it's fairly suitable. I think the smaller size is very convenient. I like the colour.
Now, what do you think of a sister?
Well, I'm sure it's very adequate, you know, but the only thing I rather like the green there because, well, it's our national colour and it sort of gives that little bit of uniqueness, you know, to the Irish person in the European market.
Do you know, I think I still have my old green passport at home in a tin box somewhere. A lot of people were very attached to that passport, Catherine, and they didn't like the change.
That's right. There was quite a bit of opposition to it. And, you know, we launched a call out for public submissions to the exhibition and we got feedback from right across the world. And it's amazing how many people have held on to that green passport that they emigrated on. People send us photos of their parents, their grandparents' green passports that they held on to many years after their death. So people have a really strong sense of connection to it as a family memento.
There are other stories as well. The stories of the marginalised as told to the passports.
Yeah, I mean, we're very conscious that, you know, the passport for a lot of people was a way out of a country that had really turned its back on them. You know, one of the things we look at is the fact that the children of unmarried mothers born in institutions, you know, used Irish passports to go abroad, to be adopted overseas. We have a copy of a passport issued to Brian Burke, as he was called when he was born in 1955, born to a single mother. He travelled to the US with his soon-to-be adoptive parents and he used actually the details that he had in this first passport to trace some of his surviving relatives in Ireland then in more recent years.
You also have, and we'll probably end with this, I'm just out of time, the passports of some very well-known people, including W.B. Yeats.
That's right, yeah. This is one of the earliest passports included in the exhibition. It was issued to Yeats along with his wife in 1923 to allow them to travel to Stockholm to accept the Nobel Prize in Literature. Yeats was the first Irish winner of that prize. And again, you see the gender dimension here. Yeats is described as the senator of the Irish Free State and poor Georgie has just a line through the space for her own occupation.
We were talking about Ballymena for all the wrong reasons this morning, but you also have a passport issued from there for the Irish writer Jan Carson.
That's right, yeah. Jan Carson, a novelist, she's based in Belfast now. She shares her story too. She was born into a Presbyterian family there in Ballymena. She was the first in her family to get an Irish passport. And it was a practical step for her, you know, post-Brexit, but also something that carried a lot of meaning, you know.
Well, you've got all the stories, you've got the passports. The exhibition runs now until the end of September. And Catherine, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That's Catherine Healy there from the Epic Museum.
And that was Mary Wilson on Morning Ireland. On Today with Claire Byrne, we heard about a new smart seat belt that will use real-time data, including the height, weight and posture of a person wearing it, and will adapt depending on traffic conditions. Geraldine Herbert, motoring editor with the Sunday Independent, had the lowdown.
Good morning, Claire.
So this is a huge overhaul to the seat belt since the thing first came out, the original three-point version. So what's going to be new?
Yeah, so basically in the event of a crash, how the current seatbelt works is it applies the same restraint force to all of the passengers in the car. And this force is based on general crash severity. Now, what the Volvo seatbelt will do is, as you said, it will gather information about each occupant's height, weight, their body shape, their seating position, but also information about the crash in terms of the direction and the speed. So it will allow each individual belt to offer far more tailored protection than the current seatbelt, which basically is a one-fit approach, a one-size-fits-all approach. Mm-hmm. So this will actually close that, I suppose, safety gap that currently exists with the seatbelt.
OK, because when you put the seatbelt on, I mean, it does at the moment, in its very non-technical way, adjust to you, doesn't it? Because there is that tension in it.
It does. But as I said, basically, when you have a crash, it applies that same pressure to everyone, regardless of their age. Now, for example, we know that older people are much more likely to die in the event of a collision, even a minor one, because they're much more frail. We know that women have different bone density to men. So none of these things are taken into consideration at the moment with the seatbelt. So therefore, if it can, I suppose, do a much more accurate profile of you, then it can respond and keep you much safer. And, you know, the tension and everything applied will be specifically to your type of body and shape mm-hmm. and size.
So they'd need to be testing this now on every sort of person, shape and size and so on, wouldn't they?
Well, they have a huge amount of data at the moment. And as I said, they'll be gathering this information and then responding in real time. But also, it will actually change. It'll be updated in terms of over-the-air updates, which means that the more information they gather, the better the protection will become over years. So it can only get better with more data.
But in terms of European standards, when they do the crash test, the dummy they use, that's a male model, isn't it? The shape of the body and the size of it. And then when they want to find out how that might impact a female, they just use a smaller man.
Yeah, basically a scaled down dummy. And I'm not sure people are aware of this. Like when you, as a car buyer, you go in and you use the Euro NCAP crash safety ratings, you know, to assess how safe a car is. And when you're buying, that's a huge consideration. But as you said, these tests are actually done for the average male body type. So all of the safety systems we devise are based on that. So this leads to a much greater increased risk for women, for children, for older people, because as I said, the safety systems are designed around men. And even when they use a crash test dummy for women, it's a scaled down men, which we are not biologically scaled down males. Now, there is a crash test dummy that has been devised that is a female, but it won't be rolled out fully till 2029.
Right. OK, so it's still a bit of a way out for that, which is hard in itself to believe. So going back to the seatbelts then, like a smartphone, the seatbelts will be able to do their own software updates and constantly improve so that they'll be connected.
Yeah, so every time they're used, this information will be fed back to Volvo and it will enhance the safety protection that they can offer. Because obviously, the more data they have, the better the protection. And this will be ongoing. And also, I would imagine Volvo have a long tradition of sharing information with competitors to encourage mass adoption. So I would imagine it won't be very long before other, you know, car manufacturers start to install the same sort of seatbelts. So, you know, that's improved safety protection for everyone.
Our cars are getting more and more connected, though, aren't they? Even now, before we come to this seatbelt technology. I mean, is this moving closer and closer to self-driving? Because anyone who has a newer car and puts it into cruise control, for example, knows that now it's very different to what it was even 5 years ago, because it's deciding on the braking distance between you and the car in front. There's assisted lane changing. All of this is moving towards the driver not having to do very much at all.
Yeah, all of these systems, you know, have synergy with autonomous driving systems, and that's what they're working towards. And as you say, more and more of our cars becoming connected and it's becoming intelligent and it can respond to real life events on the road. And we see this, you know, we see this with more and more of them. But again, you know, there's a lot of people, I suppose, Claire, that are still driving very basic cars. And I suppose that's the thing. It takes a long time for these improvements to actually, you know, filter down. The average age of an Irish car is about 9.5 years. If we go back a decade, in a decade, a lot of things have changed. So it'll take a long time before these systems actually, you know, become really mainstream on the road. But they are improving all the time, and they are becoming just, you know, standard features in new cars.
Geraldine Herbert, motoring editor with the Sunday Independent, on Today with Claire Byrne. Dermot Whelan was in for Oliver Callan today, and in his opening monologue, his thoughts on the show we all love to hate, Love Island.
But maybe the drab weather is one of the reasons so many of us turn to TV for a bit of escapism. And at this time of year, Love Island tends to make the headlines, but not for the right reasons. Today, Trout Pouts and Mangled English, How Love Island Warped Our Youth, is the headline in the Daily Telegraph today. The reality show has had a disastrous effect on young people since it began 10 years ago, says journalist and author Kate Wills, who calls it tacky. The TV show features, of course, bikini and short-wearing 20-somethings lolling around a Majorcan villa in the hope of finding love and winning £50,000 in front of cameras for everyone to see every night for 5 weeks. This article says a decade of hot tub shenanigans in Casa Amor has brought big changes to the way young people dress, talk, date and behave in general. But the show has also reflected the shifts that wider society has undergone. And it has grown at a time when social media has exploded. And another writer, Chloe Combi, the author of Generation Z, Their Voices, Their Lives, says the show has held a mirror up to society and tracked the rise of porn, the growth in online misogyny, how young people feel about mental health and body image. She says young people will talk about their desire to get a Love Island makeover or a Love Island face. And although there has been a backlash against skinniness being the ideal and a glimmer of body positivity, she says, I think ultimately the ideal body shape has simply been replaced with equally unobtainable body types. And this has led to the wrinkle-free skin, perfect white teeth, or turkey teeth, as they're called as well, sculpted cheekbones and honed, deeply tanned limbs. And that's not just the women, incidentally, either. Young men are now facing unrealistic body standards too. And of course, the allure of the show for some people is not just about love or the cash prize. It's about lucrative brand deals and huge social media followings that could come from being on the show. The richest Love Island contestant, if you're interested, is boxer Tommy Fury, who has an estimated worth of £10 million thanks to his high-profile boxing matches and brand deals with the likes of Marks and Sparks. He teamed up with Molly Mae Haig from the show, and they stuck together as a couple until the end of the series, and then they remained a pair once out of the villa as well. Chloe Conby, the author, also says the language used on the show is where it's had a big impact too. Phrases like, he's giving me the ick, or she's magging me off, have become common parlance for whole generations of people because of Love Island. In 2024, in fact, the ick was added to the Cambridge Dictionary. I think the ick was used by us before that show. They're not getting that one. They took Colin Farrell. Now they're trying to take the ick. I think that was knocking around, but maybe obviously it became more popular. Even quite complex psychological terms such as gaslighting, a form of psychological manipulation, have been made mainstream thanks to contestants describing toxic behaviour on Love Island. But over the past 10 years, Love Island has periodically been held up as an example of the damaging effects of reality TV on mental health after the suicides of two former contestants, Sophie Graydon and Mike Thalassatis, as well as its presenter, Caroline Flack. And the prevalence of mental health issues on the show reflects the high rates of depression and anxiety among Gen Z as a whole. One in three 18 to 24 year olds now report they've experienced a common mental health problem such as depression or anxiety disorder, compared with one in four back in 2000. And I have to say, anytime I've seen this programme, it reminds me of, you know, those nature documentaries where you see loads of seals lying around on hot rocks, just all wet and oily, just there lolling in the sun, and every now and again there's a big effort and they roll over onto the other side. That's what I think about when I see the show. And I have to say, it's not a show that tends to be on at all in my house. And I'm really happy about that. My two boys, they're 19 and 17, have never shown any interest in the TV show Love Island, thank God. And I'm sort of praying that my 14-year-old daughter doesn't suddenly realise it exists and starts getting obsessed. Because I think the damage these shows do is real. And the body image pressure, as we said, is, you know, it's not just on young girls, having a similar effect on young boys, with more of them developing mental health issues and eating disorders due to the pressure of looking ripped and working out all the time and having to have protein and everything that goes into their mouth, and just have that element of perfection. And it's just not real. And, you know, I get the feeling that particularly as parents, we spend so much of our time these days, I don't know if you feel it too, we're sort of pointing at things that we know collectively are damaging to us, and especially our kids, like these kinds of reality shows and so many aspects of social media. And yet it just continues. It just keeps rolling on, and another series of this Love Island rolls around, and we're all sort of trapped in this learned helplessness. Where, you know, even when presenters like the lovely Caroline Flack, you know, take their own lives as a result of being involved with things like Love Island and the reaction they can generate on social media, even when all that happens, the following year, the new season rolls around and everybody's talking about it like they've just brought out a new flavour of Coca-Cola. Now, maybe you have a different opinion on this, and you may like these kinds of shows and the escapism associated with a lot of reality TV. But I mean, how many more psychologists and psychotherapists and mental health professionals do we need to hear from, and scientists who are pointing to real data that shows that this stuff is damaging our children, before we feel like we can actually do something about it? And it's that kind of that helplessness, that sense of helplessness that really gets to me. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you who said what and who was bitchy to who on Love Island last night, because I think it's a load of BS and I'm never going to watch it. So there you go.
Well said, Dermot. Later on the show, we heard about a relatively new charity in Ireland, the Gaelic Woodland Project, which has planted thousands of native Irish trees with the help of 50 volunteers on a 12-acre site in County Mayo. Owen Connachton, who founded the project, spoke to Dermot.
Hey, good morning. Great to be here.
It's Dermot here chatting to you. And did I get the number 5,000 native Irish trees right, or is there more?
Somewhere between 8,000 and 9,000 native Irish trees. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
It's a big site.
Yeah. How did you come across the site?
I actually got a phone call from a farmer that wanted to retire, and he didn't want his neighbour to buy his land. His kids didn't want to take up the farm. And he didn't want his farm hold to be parcelled out between his neighbours. Okay. So we purchased it from him.
That's incredible. So how did you get the money together for it? Was it something you had yourself, or was it something the community managed to do?
Do you know, Dharma, it's been a long road. I started the charity in 2019, so we were fundraising for 6 years. A tenacious group we are. We're like a social experiment, bringing people together. Mm. So we're powered by people from all over the island and indeed around the world. We had 36 fundraisers in 12 months. And the idea was organise any kind of event and throw the money in the kitty. We've got a land kitty here.
Yeah.
So in one weekend, we had a very, very civil garden party in Carlow, and the same weekend, we had a drum and bass party in Tralee. So,
well, look, whatever gets money into the kitty, as you say, into the Gaelic Woodland Project, what I love is that they're native trees. And it's one of the sad things. We can blame Oliver Cromwell for robbing all our native forests to build ships for the English fleets. But for some reason, we fell in love with these firs that aren't native to our country.
Yeah.
And what kind of trees are you planting?
Entirely Irish provenance, native Irish trees. So
what would they
for my
be?
Master's dissertation, I studied the rewilding of post-productive landscapes. So I've done 4 years worth of research into the restoration of Irish habitat. So this is a vessel to a kind of a bridge between academia and action. Mm. Where we raised €68,000, we used all the money to buy the land, and we're planting four different native Irish forest types.
Yeah,
we're planting the old oak on the hill. The old oak would be like kind of predominant forest type of Ireland. It's very, everyone knows the Irish oak.
Beautiful.
That would have been the main forest type. But then we also have the alluvial forest, which grows along the rivers, the wet woodland, which grew along the edges of the bogs, and experimenting with a Scots pine Mire woodland, which is actually an extinct forest type. And on the journey, we're teaching everybody about it. So it's active learning through custodianship. And it seems to people really enjoy it. We've had over 2,000 volunteers join us over the last few years. So everyone's learning as we go together.
Yeah. I just think, you know, no matter how complex we get or how important we think we are as humans and all the technology we have, there's a connection between us and the woods and the forests and the trees. And I think
definitely. That's
something that you're definitely tapping into. If people are feeling it and they're going, yes, I need to be involved, where do people go?
They can come on to our website, GaelicWoodlandProject.com. Mm. We're also very active on Instagram, Gaelic Woodland Project. We organise, we're all volunteers, you know, so we do what we can. But every month or 2 months, we go into old forests and we turn invasive species into firewood, which we give away for free.
Mm.
So we do that very regularly. We do all the training, we have the insurance, and we teach people about Irish ecology through the Irish language as well.
I love it. Well, look, keep up the great work. I've got to leave it there.
Owen Connachton from the Gaelic Woodland Project chatting to Dermot Whelan this morning. Are we losing our sense of community and more interested in going through lives all by ourselves? That's what Claire Byrne wanted to know when she was joined by regular guests, Dr. Harry Barry, GP and mental health specialist, and Dr. Anne-Marie Craven from the Department of Psychology at the University of Limerick.
Are we losing our sense of community, Harry?
I think we are. You know, I think we traditionally have always seen ourselves as the land of community. Do you know, the land of the GA, the church, the, you know, the, all the different varying groups and all the rest of it. But I think there is worrying kind of traits coming in. There's an old saying that whatever happens in America eventually finds its way here. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that that's kind of quietly what's been happening over the last, say, 10 years, maybe particularly.
The evidence from America tells us that they are going it alone.
Terrifying. Well, America's just going more and more and more individualistic. Think about this, that 40% of American marriages end up in divorce, 50% of them are unmarried, and 25% of them are living alone. Do you know what I mean? Mm. There's also a huge rise in loneliness in the 18 to 25 age group. So even in America, they're starting to get increasingly concerned. And we can see, I refuse to go into the whole area of Trump land, do you know what I mean, et cetera, et cetera. I just refuse to go there.
Stay safe.
Stay safe. I'm out of that. But I do think that Ireland, I think there's a real worrying statistic for me when I was kind of looking at this, and that is that Ireland has been seen as the most lonely country in Europe. That's the highest rate of loneliness in Europe. And I think that's a warning bell, do you know what I mean?
Right.
We're moving from that wonderful community-based Ireland that we have known in the past to a very modern, you know, individualistic kind of approach to life.
Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Okay, well, let's find out what Anne-Marie thinks about this, about where we might be headed. Do you agree with that, Anne-Marie, that loneliness statistic that Harry mentions, that is the warning bell around individualism?
Yeah, it's certainly relevant. And that was the EU-wide poll in 2022. We did top that, right? So it was about 20% of people feeling quite lonely. And Leah's research as well, so commercial organisations have been involved in research that also suggests loneliness is a problem in Ireland. 93% of people think it is. So that is an issue. And I think Harry rightly mentions the US there, but actually, if you look globally at trends in individualism, almost every country is creeping upwards. Maybe a little bit slowly, but we're certainly creeping upwards in terms of statistics like percentage of people living alone. And although separation and divorce are people's right and often very welcome decisions people make, it's also an indicator, I suppose, of the priorities people place on their own expression compared to, say, family or community orientation.
I mean, there's people listening to this and say, well, I'm very involved in my children's school, or I'm very involved still in my church, although we know that organised religion and involvement in it is declining. GAA clubs, fundraising for various charities. I mean, all of those things still happen in towns and villages and cities around the country, right?
They do still happen, though I know in West Clare they're looking for more people for the GAA. So if anyone wants to consider relocating there, you'd be giving them an awful boost, which would be welcome. These things still happen. I mean, it's a slow increase, but the global data suggests that Ireland is one of the countries with an increase. Very few countries are showing a decrease in either individualistic practices like living alone or individualistic values. So, for example, if we ask people how important it is to teach children to be independent, right, rather than to conform or be more obedient and listen to mammy and daddy, that's an indicator of an individualistic kind of value. And all of these things are creeping up. So although we do see, of course, communities that are thriving, we also have areas that are not thriving so much. And globally, the evidence is suggesting that this is on the rise.
And it's better for us, Harry, in your view, to be involved in community in some way or other.
Yes, I think, you know, I think it's very interesting, you know, Claire, to also ask the question, well, why are we losing our sense of community? Do you know what I mean? What's actually happening? And I think it's worth looking just a little bit more broadly at that. I think really there's been a mass movement from rural to urban areas. There's a lot of hollowing out of towns. I mean, I travel around the country a good bit, and I see this major hollowing out of towns and villages all over the place. I think there's been a huge problem with emigration. I think there's been the decline in the church, the demise of the pub and the post office and all these community things. So all of these things and the rise in social media, and a very important one that I think we don't talk about is that a lot of people are falling into the trap of thinking that what we call a lifestyle enclave is a community. In other words, suppose I I feel my enclave is the gym, or I go to my yoga group or whatever like that. I believe that that's my community, but actually it's not. Community is a slightly different thing. Community is the best way of describing the difference between the individual and the community. The individual, it's about me, mm-hmm. and the community, it's about us. Do you know what I mean?
But so what it's if you're going to the yoga class once or twice a week and then you're going for coffee or lunch with those people and you ring with them during the week and the rest of it?
I'm not saying that that's not that good for us. Do you know what I mean? Of course it is, and it's really, really good for us. But it's different to community. Community is more about more like putting out the arms, do you know what I mean, and bringing us all in, do you know what I mean? Whereas when you split away from that yoga group, there is no sense of community, do you know what I mean, left from it. Do you
think something important about that yoga group as well is you're going there for yourself primarily. So the difference between having an individualistic perspective and a more community-oriented one is that in individualism, we prioritise our own self-expression, our own independence, our own needs at that little bit more, whereas a more community orientation, a person in this kind of culture would think, well, do you know what, I might go to yoga, but maybe, you know, there's a something that might benefit more than just myself if I went. Maybe there's a dance class that's short a few people, or it's not going to keep running. So the decisions are coming from a different kind of place.
So it's about working together then for the common good. That's how we're defining community, is it, Emery?
Well, we're defining it, I suppose, in terms of valuing beyond ourselves, right? And there's nothing wrong with looking out for ourselves as well, and we need to mind ourselves, and it's great when people have that freedom for self-expression. But cultures do differ on the extent to which we prioritise self-expression versus community. So, for example, if you think of a person choosing a career path based on their own personal passion rather than any family expectations, or rather than what might be something good to do in your community, right, that would reflect an individualistic perspective. That's not a bad thing. That's just what that is. Whereas a more community-oriented person or person living in that kind of culture might make a decision to choose a career path that might benefit that wider community, maybe more likely to choose a caring profession, or maybe to support a family business to thrive over generations for the good of their family rather than their own personal feelings.
A listener has been in touch, Harry, to say here in our village it's impossible to get people involved in community. They commute to work, they come home and they never engage.
That's what worries me. Do you know what I mean? That we're all moving to, let's be blunt about it like that, how many gates are you seeing now and increasingly in driveways? Do you know what I mean? In other words, instead of opening our hearts and our doors and our lives to other people, we want to shut down and be, you know, almost, it's almost this self-protection thing. And you asked a really good question. You say, well, what is the risk to our mental health?
Yeah.
And I think this is a really important thing. Like, I am seeing increasingly all over the place a rise in burnout, a rise in toxic stress, a rise in loneliness. And loneliness is, I think loneliness is often associated with an increase in anxiety, an increase. Really, really important one for me is this link between individualism and suicide or self-harm. In other words, the community puts its arm around you. So you have a kind of a sense of other people being there for you. Do you know what I mean? Whereas if it's very much about you, and you feel yourself a failure or worthless, or whatever, it's a very, very short jump. Do you know what I mean?
So a sense of being part of a community might just give you more resilience.
More resilience, exactly. It's really, really important. So I think we're more likely to have depression. I think we're more likely to go down the road of addiction. I think we're more likely to self-harm. Do you know what I mean? If we're very, very individualistic. Also, I think individualism is very much associated with things like perfectionism. Do you know what I mean? It's all about me. I have to be the best. And, you know, why are our kids, our young people, and a lot of us adults, unable to cope with failure? Do you know what I mean? Because, like, if failure was always seen as part of learning, do you know what I mean? And we learn through our community as well. We watch our community. You know, for example, our GAA club go out and get hammered, do you know what I mean? So we learn very quickly that failure is a part of life, do you know what I mean? But actually, it's not the failure, it's a taking part in the sport, do you know what I mean? That's really, really important.
I just wonder how much of this, Anne-Marie, you know, if we are seeing a breakdown in community structures, is down to people not having the time. Mm. you know, as that listener said, people are commuting for work. And whether you're commuting or not, if you're doing a full week, it can be hard then to find the time to get your house in order and go out then and bake cakes or train the local club or whatever it is you might do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we can't really disentangle this from all the policy decisions we make. I mean, we have seen a tipping point where more people are in urban areas and there are fewer in rural areas. So those areas are thinned out a little bit. And we also see more people being able to commute, but that's time that is fatiguing, right? And it also takes you outside your community for your work. So you spend a lot of time invested in that particular workplace, and then you come back and you don't have the energy anymore, I suppose. And we're also seeing people being unable to access housing in their communities, of course. So when you have a more transient population, it's a very big ask for people to invest in a community that's not where they want to be or where their tenancy is insecure. And we also have a situation in Ireland where a lot of children, if they have a disability, do not get to go to school in their community, and people are busy investing their time into that. So any decision we make structurally about how people move about in the world, I think, has implications for community. And I think one other area, if we put all that aside, is when Harry mentioned the church and the GAA, it just really struck me that although meeting other people is not exactly the same as community, it is important, right? And it's a step towards community. And in Ireland, I don't think we do well enough at creating spaces that are low cost for people to actually meet. And this is reflected then in people making more of their homes. So they're putting the gates up, they're building an extension, okay? They're watching Netflix instead of going to the cinema. But if we had more third places that weren't home and weren't work, that were accessible, that were somewhat weatherproof, I think we'd have more opportunities for people to make those initial connections with people that do help foster community.
Well, a listener says that it can be simple as saying hello and giving a smile to somebody. Yep. They say, as someone who's a blow-in to a beautiful community in West Cork, the kindness of neighbours I've experienced is second to none. I walk every day with my dog and my neighbours stop and chat and I can ask for help, and I have done any time I'm in trouble. Say hello and smile and it works. Can it be as simple as that?
It is. Well, I'm probably renowned for this, Claire, do you know what I mean? I've always believed that it's that one-to-one connection. It's that stopping, taking that minute for the person who might need that couple of words at that moment in time. That's actually real community. Do you know what I mean? In other words, caring about other people. This sense of you matter. Do you know what I mean? It's not just all about me. Do you know what I mean? It's also about you. And we can create our own, even local little community by just even the people around us, do you know what I mean? By being there for them, by stopping for them, by chatting to them. Instead of this awful world that we're creating now at the moment, I think it was wonderfully described by your listener, do you know what I mean? Where we get up early in the morning, we dump our children somewhere, we commute all day long, we work hard, we commute in this awful commute back, collect our children, and we're all exhausted and we all collapse. Do you know what I mean? What kind of life is this? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I only don't mind at school, to be fair now.
But Anne-Marie, do you agree that you can start with the simple hello and the smile?
You can start with the simple hello. So technically we'd call that a minimal social interaction, and the evidence is well stacked in favour of that being good for yourself and for other people. And it also helps create a culture in the area you live, that people live in a kind area, that people live in a place where somebody will greet you. And that's only a small thing. But how can you feel part of a place where people don't even say hello? So I would really encourage people, if you're on a bus, if you're at a coffee shop, if you're walking down the street, you know, just give a wave, a nod, a smile. It might make the difference to someone, and at minimum it will create a sense that this is a place where people are kind.
Yeah, you know, and people are agreeing. One listener saying it's a really interesting conversation, and it's 100% right, caring about each other and creating a local community. And isn't that a great simple way to start?
Yes.
By saying hello and offering a smile and taking it from there.
Yeah, and you will be astonished how quickly you will create a little community around you by even that simple conversations. And, you know, it's that caring for another. I can't say enough. The greatest bulwark for our mental health is actually being there for other people, being with each other, caring about each other. That's how we actually help each other, even in a wider sense, in the community sense, to reduce all these mental health difficulties.
And that was Dr. Harry Barry and Dr. Anne-Marie Craven on Today with Claire Byrne. Dermot Whelan's guest this morning was comedian and podcaster Jarlath Regan.
So good to be here. Thanks a lot, man, for having me.
Lovely to have you on the show. I hear you're big in America now.
Oh, yeah. I can't get my head through the door.
But you were doing some shows over there.
I did a big tour of America just in April there, down the West Coast and then across. We did the whole thing. And
yeah,
brought,
sold out.
Yeah, sold the whole thing out. And it is, it's a head spinner, but I guess it's the power of the gram and these social media platforms.
Well, you know, we were having a moan about the negatives of these things, but there are positives, particularly for creators like yourself who can reach a whole new audience and, 100%. You know, put food on the table through being creative, which is incredible. And you can garner that whole world audience. I guess you're getting messages from all around the world. Can they relate to the Irish mammy stuff, even if they're not Irish?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. I mean, I put a lot of stand-up up there as well, which is kind of universal stuff. And you think the Irish mammy, everyone thinks it's so their own thing. My ma's so different from everyone else's. I get messages from, you know, this is Jewish mothers, this is Italian mothers, this is Sri Lankan mothers. It's mind-blowing the connection that people have that way, that they all seem to go to the same mom university. I don't know. They all figured out how to do it the same way. They all say the same things. But was mad over that US tour was just, I expected it all to be Irish people, but it was... Mm. By and large, about 80% Americans. And I was like, how is this happening?
And when you walk out there, we'll play a clip of one of your Irish mammyisms in a sec. Yeah. But when you walk out on the stage and you go, oh, wow, these are all Americans. What's different? Is there anything different for you? Well, I mean, sometimes an Irish audience can be tough because everyone in the audience thinks they should be up on the stage.
Of course, they can all tell stories. They've all got bits. They're ready to go. If you come to them, they have a smart answer for you. I think that I definitely don't adjust things. But when you realise that most of them are American, it's kind of freeing in some way because you then you get to there's an awful lot of comedy in just explaining things, just like things that we would take as given. They're just hotkeys. Joe Duffy. You can explain Joe Duffy to American people. What was it I said? It was like Howard Stern. I can't remember. There was a cross between Howard Stern and something else, but he's got that kind of trying to explain.
I think Howard Stern and an Irish mammy.
Yeah. But it's like Howard Stern with teeth because he will track down the person that wronged you and, you know, pants them on live radio, which is not something that Howard does. That kind of explanation of what we see as normal and that there's so much fun to be had in that. The show is the show. Like I write a show each year. That show that I was doing over there was called In Bits. I'm still in the helix this weekend, next weekend with that. Is that this weekend? I don't know. I've lost track of time. It is this weekend. And yeah, so you write the show and you're trying to write it so that it can reach everyone.
Yeah, so I guess you've changed your comedy writing a little bit now with that in mind. You're going, I got to make these things universal, or a little bit more universal.
Well, look, I've always thought that the best songs at the wedding are the floor fillers that gets everyone dancing. And to me, writing a joke that gets the whole family to laugh is the hardest thing. Like you can get the kids to laugh easily, but trying to get the generations, everyone to come to the show and enjoy it in the same way.
Yeah.
That's really hard needle to thread. So that's always how I'm writing them now.
It's reflected in the demographics who go to your shows. So you get everybody in there. You get the younger crowd, you get the granny and granddads, and you get the mammies. Let's have a listen.
Another run. Didn't you go for a run yesterday?
I wouldn't mind, but she's the one that's complaining she has no energy all the time.
But didn't you do a marathon last year or some sort of fun run? Do you remember your man up the road who used to do the marathons? He used to run all the time. Do you know where he is now? I don't know where he is now. Do you know?
Don't even talk to me about the football and the hurling. These sports have gone so dangerous. It's so physical. It's rough now. And I blame the energy drink.
Swimming?
Your brother was a fabulous swimmer.
I blame the energy drinks.
Yeah. Too much energy now.
Those connections that are made with no scientific backing. Just that's it now.
And
we've
said
decided.
With such authority.
I love the reviews you get. Regan is an expert storyteller, and this is a beautifully constructed show that I could have happily listened to for twice its length, says the arts desk. And then the next review is a superb guest, Airbnb.
Both as meaningful, right?
Yeah. You've got lots going on outside of that, obviously, as well. Mm. You've got the podcasts, your podcast empire. What you must have the schedule down to a T now, down to a fine, fine art in terms of, okay, we do this podcast. Because, okay, so you've got Irishman Abroad. You're on a little bit of a hiatus there when you do some writing.
Taking a break from that at the moment.
You do the running podcast as well.
Sonia O'Sullivan, which we just finished a kind of a project with a squad that she selected. We brought them down to Cove for her 10-mile road race. And I was doing an America podcast with Marion McKeown, which we paused as well. And I do a parenting podcast with my wife called Honey, You're Ruining Our Kid. She's a child behaviourist.
Yeah.
In terms of whether I have the schedule, I mean, I'd be looking to you, Dermot, going busy and wrecked. You know, you're trying to spin all the plates.
Mm.
And, you know, I'm in this, like everybody out there, you're trying to be a dad. You're trying to do it all. And in some ways, that's where a lot of the comedy comes from. Is that none of us are getting it right. Everyone, like in terms of the parenting, that podcast is about trying to raise your kid not to be a gobshite. And the biggest fear every parent has is that the horse is already bolted. It's too late.
I know, because I remember you talking about Mikey, your son, and moving back from the UK and seeing how long it would take for his English accent to disappear. And I realised, when I was thinking about it, it's kind of like sometimes in Ireland we treat the English accent like a bit of a silly haircut that you got that hopefully you can grow out of, you know.
It is funny that before we came back, everyone was asking, has he got one?
Mm-hmm.
And then when he came back, it was gone in the space of 2 weeks. And it's just people just settle in to that. But it was...
And what was it like doing the podcast with Tina? Like, I know you guys off mic. You know, I know how close you are, but it's a different dynamic when you start putting microphones in front of each other.
Sure. Well, she's also my manager. So she is, you know, she's booking the tour. Mm. She's arranging all of this stuff that we're doing right now. So, yeah.
Who suggested that?
Well, I did, to be honest.
Okay.
I mean, she's a really highly qualified educator and child behaviourist.
So perfect for managing a comedian on the road then.
She's well used to dealing with these little characters who think
tantrums.
Everything's about them.
Yeah.
And the podcast came about because she was just getting quizzed at the end of every school day by people as to what to do. My kid won't eat. My kid won't sleep in their own bed. We're having trouble toilet training. And because she'd worked with severe behavioural issues for 20 years, she usually had a strategy that would work with them. And someone said, you should do your own podcast. And sure, I was sitting there with the mics and I said, let's give it a go. She came up with the title, Honey, You're Ruining Our Kid. And off we went. What's it like to work with your wife? If you love your wife, it's fantastic. And I absolutely love my wife. And this is a joy to get to spend this time
well played,
with her.
Jarlath, yes. Well played, Jarlath. Well played.
Yeah, that's not to say, I can't speak for her. Her version of that is, you have no idea, Dermot, what I'm putting up with every day.
So if she's managing your tours, is she going on the road with you then?
Yes.
And Mikey too?
Yeah, they came to America. They went up and down the East and West Coast.
How cool.
It's amazing. But like it is... I built for it. Right? I've been doing stand-up 20 years. You know, they aren't used to the travel and the stress of it all. It's not tarring roofs, but it is immensely tiring. And I'm pretty spent at this point. So a lot of the time I'm just trying to arrange the day so that everybody gets rest while we also get to see the Golden Gate Bridge and whatnot.
Do you find it easy to relax before a show? I always found that was one of the hardest parts of stand-up was the waiting around for the show that night. Mm. And particularly if I had family with me, they're all sort of in holiday mode of, yay, let's go. And all you're thinking is, I got the show. One of the audience are going to be like, and I find it very hard to straddle both.
It's a strange little anxiety, isn't it? And it's very hard to explain that to people because they'll be like, come on, we'll meet for a pint before the show. And you're like, I'm actually just trying to keep my energy to where I need it.
If you want to see me staring into the distance and not saying much.
But you know, that said, Dermot, I'm definitely not staring into the distance Roy Keane-like out the window, simmering, waiting to pounce. I'm so grateful that after 20 years of doing this, people are coming and we're filling the Helix and filling the Three Olympia. Like, I do wake up every day going, a joy, a dream.
But you've worked hard for it. You really have worked hard. Because you and I started comedy in the same year, 2004. And, you know, you see the efforts that your peers are using, you know.
But it's all in, isn't it?
Yeah.
You really have to go all in with stand-up. I mean, people will never really get it until they've done it like you have.
Would you be happy if Mikey, your son, said, "Dad, I want to be a comedian"?
If he, I would support him in whatever
go
he does.
Go to your room.
Get out of my house. That's it. I don't see it happening, but, you know, I just want to get behind what he's doing. Like, he's into all sorts of mad stuff right now, but I'm just trying to get behind it because I really think that the thing you're trying to get your kid to do is to follow their passion. And if they can do that,
yeah,
something good will come from it, as long as their passion
basketball
isn't criminal.
Has always yeah, basketball has always been one of your passions.
I
guess it's one of his now as well, because that's what we tend to do. We force our passions on our children until they're old enough to go, hang on a sec,
he
I hate this.
He appears to be passionate about this basketball.
Yeah.
He just shoveled clothes and balls into his room and he appears to be passionate about it now.
You're tall enough. I used to play a bit of basketball in primary school, but you know, that was until people started growing, then that was the end of my career. You know, what is it about the sport? Because it's not top of mind for most people in Ireland. And I guess as a kid, you must have been a bit known as the guy who likes basketball.
Well, you would think, right? But I went to Newbridge, Patrician School in Newbridge, and it was a religion there. I mean, everyone played basketball. It was obviously in the golden age, Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird. Like, it was just everybody was playing basketball at that time. It's in a resurgence right now. But I was part of a generation of lads who, you know, we won in All-Ireland. We did it all. And it was just, we played it 24/7. The attraction was that it wasn't Gaelic football. Mm-hmm. And Gaelic football is very much mullock into them, drop the shoulder. You know, none of the fancy dance stuff, lads. Whereas basketball was all show. Like it's why I'm in entertainment.
Yeah.
It's all performance. Fancy clothes, trickery, moves, high-flying dunks. Mm. It was all about entertainment. And I realise now, looking back on it, that, like, I was obsessed with the sport because it was, you know, it was Hollywood. It was the big stage, the big lights, the backstage, the preparation for it, and then coming out and delivering when the lights were on. And also just, it's a sport that when you're growing up in the country, as I did on the Curra, by yourself, you and the hoop, you can play for hours.
Certainly,
you don't need a gang.
Hill walking wasn't an option for you down there. Here, you've spoken publicly about donating a kidney to your brother. How many years ago since the operation?
2017, February 2nd, 2017, the operation took place. And
does that seem like a long time ago or yesterday?
I remember it as vividly as yesterday, for sure. It was such a real turning point in my life. Like, I definitely, it was a turning point in his life, of course. But, like, you know, it is a moment, isn't it, when you kind of put to the pin of your collar, like, are you sound? You know, are you a sound man? Are you willing to do this? And I always think that Irish guys are chasing a legacy of soundness. That's why they're buying so many pints for each other. They just want to be considered nice guys.
Yeah, but a lot of us, you know, are, myself included, would like to be organ donors, but not while we're alive. Well, that's the difference.
I don't know, Dermot. I feel like if someone important to you came to you today and said, I need it, would you consider going forward?
Depends how important they were.
Yeah, well, I'd say if Dave came to you.
Yeah. I've three brothers. If one of them came to me, you know, you'd like to think, of course you would, just like you did.
You would. I had to think about it, but I didn't have to think about it.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's...
Do you talk about it? What's your brother's name?
Adrian.
Do you talk to him about it still? You're like, how's the kidney?
I mean, I try not to lord it over him.
Yeah. That's pretty impressive bragging rights, in fairness, you know. Anytime there's a lull in the conversation at Christmas.
My family never bring it up. It never comes up in our family, ever.
Yeah.
And it doesn't come up at Christmas. We don't do a toast to it or anything on the day that it... It doesn't
you don't
up.
Still walk around clutching your side?
Occasionally, I'll go, This is what you got me for Christmas.
Are there any health implications, whatever it is, eight years on?
Yeah, here's the biggest health implication. Mm. I'm healthier than I've ever been. I have a greater respect for my body than I ever had. Prior to that, I would have drank like a fish.
Yeah.
I would have occasionally smoked a cigarette on a night out. I wouldn't dream of it. I've run 3 marathons since. I'm in the shape of my life. And
why is that, do you think? What is it about having a piece of you removed that gave you that respect?
Well, your body is suddenly, you're so much more aware of what it is, what it's doing, its finite nature,
fragility.
How lucky you are to have it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and they gave me a clean bill of health and said, you're in great, Nick, and you are ready for this. And sometimes you're walking around thinking, oh God, I'm not that fit, I'm not that strong. But I was, you know, I was in great shape having done all that. Mm. So I wondered, well, what could I be like if I actually made an effort and went out and exercised?
So why do we need 2 then?
I don't know. Why do we need 2 nipples?
They're both. Symmetry?
Yeah, I think it is a case of if one if one craps out, the other's ready to go.
Yeah, it's a reserve.
Many people are born with just one, and that's quite common. What's interesting is that when you donate a kidney, and for anybody who's listening now who is up for this, who's considering live donation, message me. My email is always open. I will talk over the phone with anybody that wants to discuss this, who's going for it, because there's lots of things people don't know, such as the remaining kidney will double in size to compensate for the loss of his brother. In my case, apparently my kidney is a lot bigger than Declan, the one that I gave to my brother.
Yeah.
It's plumped up and strengthened up to carry the load. Yeah.
It's not emotional eating or anything. It's just working harder.
No, yeah. It's a super kidney in there now.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got plenty of comedy out of it as well. There's plenty of stuff on YouTube about it. I wrote a show called Organ Freeman about it.
Yeah, I always loved that title. Like when you thought of Organ Freeman, you're just like, that's it. That's my work done for the day. Nothing else to do. Yeah. Did it make you and your brother closer?
You know, it definitely changed the relationship forever. I mean, you would be weird if you weren't closer. I'm partially him. It's hard not to connect with each other in a different way now.
Yeah. Would you do it again?
Oh, in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
In a heartbeat. But I draw the line at 1. Very rarely.
If he comes back for seconds, okay, so what is happening then in terms of looking forward to the rest of the year? You've had the American tour.
Yeah. The my process is this, that I like to give everybody a brand new stand-up show in January. I put it on in the Olympia Theatre for a few nights and then head off with the brand new show. So in the moment, the In Bits tour is finishing up. As I said, it's in the helix.
Is it the case as soon as something goes online, it's dead?
Yeah, well, I would release it as a stand-up special in November. Yeah. But I'm going to Australia in November before that with it. But I'm the whole time workshopping the new show. So the Gas Man is ready to go. It's now on sale.
Comedian Jarlath Regan chatting to Dermot Whelan today. And that's all we have time for on Wednesday's Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.